This is Louisiana Considered on WWNO in New Orleans and WRKF in Baton Rouge. I'm Diane Mack. Just ahead, we'll get a sneak peek at the New Orleans Opera's season opener, Rossini's The Barber of Seville, set in the French Quarter of antebellum New Orleans. And living legend, retired Xavier University president, Dr. Norman Francis, is celebrated in a one-hour WYES-TV documentary. But first, a for sale sign recently went up in front of one of the last clinics to provide abortions in Louisiana. As WWNO's Rosemary Westwood reports, following Louisiana's near total ban on abortions, the clinic has been forced to close.
Kathleen Pittman stands outside the clinic she runs, Hope Medical Group for Women, on a recent sweltering afternoon in Shreveport. It's a squat beige building that hasn't changed in decades. The sign is faded, the paint's peeling.
It's looking a little worse for wear.
Stephanie Chaffee is the clinic's second in command.
And then the other day we came out and noticed that the sign with the hours of operation had just kind of like fallen off the door.
And they have no plans to fix it. The parking lot is empty. The protesters are gone. After 40 years of making sure women in this rural part of the South had access to abortions, Hope is closing. Inside, chairs and boxes are stacked in a corner. There's an empty magazine rack and a cork board that used to hold messages of support.
I still have my plants in here because that's something that's living and growing. You know, the quiet is kind of, it's just eerie.
Hope opened in 1980. As the story goes, founder Robin Rothrock, who'd been working at a woman's clinic in Florida, was sitting at a seaside bar wondering whether to open a new clinic in Louisiana. She asked for a sign from God. Pittman says Rothrock went to the ladies' room.
And on the, inside the stall door, it said, if men could get pregnant, abortion would be a sacrament. That was her sign.
Pittman joined Hope about a decade later and took over after Rothrock passed away. In recent years, the clinic performed about 3,000 abortions annually. Pittman says they served women from every walk of life.
From the evangelical churches, from the more liberal churches, we've seen relatives of politicians come through.
Miranda Slavoff was a patient a few years ago. She's the mother of five from a conservative Christian family, and she worried her latest pregnancy, after previous complications, could kill her.
The only thing that I had that I knew I could turn to was this clinic. So, you know, what do you do then if you don't have that to turn to?
Over the years, Hope has faced physical attacks. At one point, its windows were shot out. And it's fought dozens of legal battles against laws restricting abortions. The ultimate blow came last June, when the U.S. Supreme Court overruled Roe v. Wade. Hope hung on for a few months and fought a Louisiana trigger ban that criminalizes nearly all abortions. But a state court ruling shut the clinic for good last month. Since then, it's been quiet at Hope, except for the phones that keep ringing, sometimes with a dozen calls a day.
Hope Medical Group, this is Stephanie. May I help you?
A woman on the line says she just found out she's pregnant.
You're probably looking at maybe Kansas, Illinois, or if there's a place you can get in Florida.
Kansas, Illinois, or Florida?
Yes, ma'am.
Chaffee thinks most of their former clientele can't afford to travel for an abortion. Many live in the surrounding low-income communities, and the majority are Black women. But on these calls, Chaffee can't resist urging them to do the one thing that could, one day, bring back abortion rights in Louisiana.
You need to pay attention to who you're voting for and vote.
That's why we're
having all this right now.
Pittman and Chaffee are continuing the fight, too. Hope is moving to a state where abortion remains legal. Pittman won't say where, but the goal is to be as close to Louisiana and the women here who need abortions as possible.
I want to go out on my own terms and not be the person that got shut down. I won't have it.
In the meantime, Pittman plans to come to work and sit in her cleared-out office until the building sells and she's forced to leave for good. For NPR News, I'm Rosemary Westwood in New Orleans.
You're listening to Louisiana Considered on 89.9 WWNO in New Orleans and 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. I'm Diane Mack.
If you want to understand a life well spent and making a difference in the world, Norman Francis is a man you ought to look at.
He is a man of vision, determination, faith, and strength.
We knew he was destined for something because he had all of the qualities of a leader.
Norman Francis represents all that is good about bringing people together.
WYES-TV honors the monumental life of a living legend with tonight's premiere of Dr. Norman C. Francis, A Legacy of Leadership. The one-hour documentary produced by journalist Tan Truong honors the retired Xavier University president and civil rights leader's 70-year legacy of community service. Tan Truong joins us now. Tan, congratulations and welcome to Louisiana Considered.
Thank you so much, Diane. A long-time listener, first-time guest with you, so I'm honored. Thank you so much.
Glad to have you. Tan, when you hear the name Dr. Norman Francis, what words immediately come to mind?
I think longevity first comes to mind because ultimately when you take a look at the whole of his career at Xavier University with serving 47 years as the president there, longevity hits you first. But when you dig deeper underneath the surface, you understand the complexities of the man that has been there, not only just for the length of time, but the quality of time as well. So longevity first, but as we named the documentary, A Legacy of Leadership, he leads both. I think when you take a look at his life, there's a legacy there and just the leadership qualities that he's brought at very, very important junctures in New Orleans history.
This had to be a monumental assignment for you. How does his seven-decade legacy of community service and leadership unfold in the documentary?
The origin story to me is usually the most interesting. What are some of the pivotal moments? What are some of those first moments at a person's life that kind of formulate their understanding and their worldview and serve as the North Star? So we begin with some of the areas of his life, especially in Lafayette, just growing up as a boy in the segregated South and being a son of parents to their description, to the family's description by the Francis family. They only had a third grade education. So that sets him on this path to eventually become a very, very recognized leader in the university system, in the HBCU system. So that is sort of the pivotal moment that we wanted to start with, the beginning, you know, what happened and some of the conditions that he grew up in that formulated his understanding of the world as a leader in the university system and the educational system, not just here in New Orleans, but really as an example for HBCUs throughout America.
What were some of his major accomplishments at Xavier University?
I think it was his understanding in how he approached Xavier University, that he blended faith. It's one of the, if not the only, Black Catholic university in the HBCU system. But he carved out a niche as well in understanding the pharmacy school and then staying in that lane in emphasizing the sciences and specializing in the pharmacy school. And eventually getting to a point where Xavier University was producing more Black students going into medical school than any other college and university in America at the rate that they were. It's just amazing.
Now, Xavier University was also his alma mater. Is there a story that you can tell us about his early days as a student?
There is, and we hear it through Sybil Morial. She was the wife of former New Orleans Mayor Dutch Morial. She, too, was a Xavier University student, and she talks about first meeting Norman Francis as a freshman, and she called him a bookworm. And I think that, you know, when we think of Norman Francis, we think of this person who is almost a regal figure in the university system. He's polished. He's established as a person that has a lot of prominence and influence in the city. But when Sybil Morial met him, she called him a bookworm. And I think people will get the sense of how human he was. And when he was the bookworm, fittingly, he earned a work scholarship to Xavier University and was working in the library system, repairing old books as the night supervisor, and eventually worked his way up into becoming class president of the freshman class, the sophomore class. And eventually, you know, capstoning and seeing him evolve into the president of the university is just quite fascinating. But who knew that a bookworm was going to be the president eventually?
Now, Dr. Francis was also an attorney and a civil rights leader. Can you tell us about some of his courageous moments then?
He graduated as the first African-American student from Loyola University, the law school there. But because it was segregated at the time, he wasn't allowed to stay on the campus, so he actually had to stay and find boarding at Xavier University. You know, we're dealing with some very complex issues in a very segregated time. But coming out of that era and into the 1960s, when it was his time to kind of, quote unquote, take charge and take the reins of certain situations, there were sit-in protests at the McCrory's shop on Canal Street, where one of his students was arrested, Rudy Lombard. And Dr. Francis eventually walked in at the Orleans Parish Jail to bail him out. And Dr. Francis recalls the story in doing that. As an educational leader, it was more his educational concerns about Rudy Lombard, because he said, I have to get Rudy Lombard out of jail because he has to go to Cornell. And we found that just kind of humorous, because here he's facing all these legal issues and, you know, the racial injustice at the time. And he was able to kind of walk into the jail and bail out one of the students. And eventually that case went to the Supreme Court and was struck down, and eventually laid the groundwork for some of the Jim Crow laws throughout the South to be dissolved.
Wow.
And from that point on, there were other opportunities, most notably with the Freedom Riders, when they needed shelter from an awful firebombing of their bus. Dr. Francis offered up one of the dormitories for 12 of the students to stay. Everywhere else, they were faced with threats. Dr. Francis stepped up and really solidified his stance and also the university stance on racial justice and civil rights at that point. I think when you take a look through the documentary and see all these moments that were really crucial in New Orleans history, Dr. Francis was often behind the scenes moving the pieces and getting the right people in the positions they needed to be to make things happen.
He earned a lot of praise and was awarded the Presidential Freedom Medal.
Yes, in 2006, and that was for his leadership, obviously for his time at Xavier University, but also as the co-chair and the leader of the Louisiana Recovery Authority for many of us who went through Katrina, and also the after effects and the impacts of Hurricane Rita, which hit a few weeks later after that. Louisiana was very much in a very difficult position, and probably one of the most difficult rebuilding challenges any other places faced in the last 50 to 60 years. But certainly at that time, Kathleen Blanco, who was the governor at the time, chose Dr. Francis to head up the Louisiana Recovery Authority, which oversaw the reconstruction of the infrastructure and the homes and the communities that were damaged by both storms.
And the praises just keep coming. He also has a street now named after him.
Jefferson Davis Parkway was the name of the street that was there before it was Norman C. Francis Parkway. And I think that was very much a deliberate but also natural decision to take the name of a street that once represented the president of the Confederacy, that really highlighted the divisions of the United States during the Civil War, to a person who's dedicated his life into bridging a lot of the gaps between people. So I think that the naming of the street, Norman C. Francis Parkway, which we see today, is very poignant.
And it's just awesome that he is still here to enjoy his roses.
He is. We had a premiere a few nights ago, and we have to say we were a little bit nervous, because that is the toughest but perhaps the most important audience is Dr. Francis and his family. And he said some very poignant words, so his words were very moving at the premiere.
Journalist Tom Truong, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Diane, it is a great honor. Just happy to be here. Great to hear from you.
The documentary, Dr. Norman C. Francis, A Legacy of Leadership, premieres tonight at 8 on WYES-TV, WYES.org, and on the free WYES and PBS apps. Check the website for additional information on repeat airings in October. You're listening to Louisiana Considered on 89.9 WWNO in New Orleans and 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. I'm Diane Mack. The New Orleans Opera opens its season with The Barber of Seville. This new production gives a nod to America's first city of opera, as it is set in the French Quarter of antebellum New Orleans. Ned Canty is the stage director for Rossini's comic masterpiece, and he joins us with details. Ned, welcome to Louisiana Considered.
Thanks for having me.
This is an Italian opera based on a French play and originally set in 18th century Seville, Spain. What led you to reset it in antebellum New Orleans?
This is my fifth production of this opera over the years, and all of them we have tweaked somewhat, partly because the thing that I love most about directing comedy in general is really what a through line there is. You know, going back to the Greeks and the Romans through Italian commedia dell'arte and right up into movies and sitcoms of today, and Barber of Seville especially, is a very, very recognizable, very relatable comedy. The last production of it I did was set in the 1980s as a kind of John Hughes teen rom-com, because that's really what it is. So from the start, I wanted to talk with New Orleans Opera about what can we do to have a little fun with this and really celebrate the fact that New Orleans is, in my opinion, one of the few places in America where you can get that pan-European feel with the Spanish influences, the French influences, the Italian influences, certainly, all of it coming together in one thing. And then, of course, the ultimate reason to set it in New Orleans is that the show opens with the Count having gathered a bunch of musicians on the street at 4 a.m. And there are not that many cities where you can do that, and New Orleans is certainly one of them.
It certainly is. So what is the storyline of this romantic comedy opera?
So the Count Almaviva is sick of the women that he meets wanting him for his status, for his money. In another city, he's seen a young woman, Rosina, and he has followed her back to her home city, and he has been hanging out in the early morning hours under her balcony, trying to woo her in the most romantic way he can think of. He runs into an old friend of his, Figaro. Everyone knows the Figaro, Figaro, Figaro aria, or at least the Bugs Bunny version of it, as I was introduced to it. So he runs into his old friend Figaro, and Figaro is not just a barber. He is a love broker, and he is a medic. He is a songwriter. He's all of these different things. That's what he sings about in that song. And Figaro agrees to help him find a way to court this young woman. There's a complication in that she is the ward of an older man named Bartolo, who wants to marry her because she is about to come of age and she has a very substantial dowry. And so the fact that she's a young, attractive woman is icing on the cake, but really what Bartolo is after is her money. And so he is trying to manipulate events so that he can marry her, and the Count is sort of engaged in a race against time with Rosina to figure out a way to free her, marry her, all without her learning that he's actually rich, so that she falls in love with him for himself. And there are many other shenanigans and obstacles and twists and turns, which is, of course, what makes any good romantic comedy a good romantic comedy.
Yeah, there is so much going on there, and the Count, he is a man of many disguises.
He is, he is. I think the idea that masks and disguise play such an important role in this was another, as we started talking about setting in Mardi Gras. And of course, keep in mind, I speak as someone who loves New Orleans, has visited many times. I live in Memphis, just upriver. You know, this fun of masks and this freedom that the masks and the disguises give the Count to act more freely than he would be able to otherwise, that also seemed to really tie into something about New Orleans that was very attractive.
Now, who are the principal singers?
I'm going to go through them and hope I don't mess any of them up. But Matthew Swenson, making his American debut, very, very exciting tenor, who's been in Germany for a while now. Matthew is our Conte Almaviva. John Moore is our Figaro. Raven McMillan is our Rosina, our young lover. Adam Lau plays Basilio, who is sort of Figaro's rival love broker. He's sort of the Pepsi to Figaro's Coke in the city. Kendra Beasley, who is our Berta. And I feel like I'm leaving out one. Ashraf Sawalem is our Baratolo, who is a wonderful singer, Egyptian singer, who's lived in the States for a long time, and is also, when he is home in Egypt, he is the voice for many Disney characters. So he is the voice of Mickey Mouse in the Arabic-speaking world, as well as the Sea Witch and a bunch of other folks.
Wow. The music will be very familiar to audiences, as it has had commercial appeal with songs showing up in many places, including, as you earlier alluded to, cartoons. What are some of the popular tunes?
I think the most popular is Figaro's entrance aria, the Largolal Factotum, and that is the la-la-la-la, la-la-la-la, that he sings, and also where we get the bravo Figaro, bravo Verissimo, and his Figaro, 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 or, you know, those things that show up, not just in Bugs Bunny, but in SpongeBob SquarePants and, you know, all other kinds of cartoons, and is, you know, parodied on commercials to sell cereal or whatever. That, I think, is famous, as well as the overture, which is actually what the music from the Bugs Bunny cartoon Rabbit of Seville is, actually words set to this wonderful comic overture of ta 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 ta. That one, which again, I guarantee you the people involved in the show are going to play and sing that much, much better than I just was able to.
It's quite catchy when you're, you know, sitting and watching an opera, maybe one you have not seen before, and you start to recognize all these songs. And I didn't know that came from The Barber of Seville.
Yeah. I did not come from opera. I didn't grow up with opera. I came to it fairly late in life for most opera folks, in my mid-20s. The second opera I ever saw was the first opera I was working on. So I always tried to direct shows and think about them from the perspective of that first timer, the person who is coming in and discovering it. So I try to make sure that everything we do works that way. And I think especially Barber of Seville is a great first opera because of the fun, because of the joy. Nobody dies the way that they do in many operas. So it really is a great first time opera. And I also have found over the almost three decades now doing this, that when I direct it from the perspective where it's for someone who's never seen this opera before, people who've seen it a dozen times find new things. They sort of rediscover it in a very special way.
And why would you say after more than 200 years is this work by Rossini so popular with audiences?
So I think this story of a young couple that wants to be together and the older generation that's trying to keep them apart, I mean, that is almost every story that we see in popular culture. So it's an immediately relatable story. And it just features this music by a genius who in his time was as influential as the Beatles or Elvis or any other masterwork. And the music remains as relevant as that music does today.
Yeah. Stage director Ned Canty, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The New Orleans Opera presents Rossini's The Barber of Seville, set in the French Quarter of antebellum New Orleans. This new production opens at the Mahalia Jackson Theater for the Performing Arts with performances on Friday, September 30th and Sunday, October 2nd. More info is online at neworleansopera.org. This has been Louisiana Considered. I'm Diane Mack. Thanks to our guest, journalist Tom Trong, stage director Ned Canty, and WWNO's Rosemary Westwood. Our managing producer is Alana Schreiber, and our digital editor is Caitlin Umholtz. Our engineers are Garrett Pittman, Aubrey Procell, and Thomas Walsh. You can listen to Louisiana Considered Monday through Friday at noon and 7:30 p.m. It's available on Spotify, Google Play, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Major support for Louisiana Considered provided by Rouse's Markets, a Louisiana shopping experience, with additional support from Louisiana Farm Bureau Federation.